But first, Emmy Thomas. That is not actually her real name. She used a pseudonym to write her book Confessions of a Sociopath, A Life Spent Hiding in Plain Sight. As you can tell from the title, Thomas is a diagnosed sociopath. She's one of the 4% of highly successful, non-criminal sociopaths that make up the U.S. population. Anne Strange Champs talked with her.
Emmy, when did you first become aware that you were different from other people? Do you feel like this is something you've always known?
I think I always thought that I was different, but I didn't really think sociopath, obviously. When I was little, I thought, maybe I'm just smart, maybe I'm just Mormon, maybe it's something having to do with my big family, big musical family. Maybe there are other things that are sort of idiosyncratic about me that are just chance. And I don't think I really realized how systematic my differences were or what their particular nature were until law school, when we were all trained to think like lawyers, very logically and rationally, and my classmates and I did that well. And we did it pretty much in lockstep and did it in similar ways until we started talking about controversial subjects like the death penalty or abortion. And then my classmates would have emotional reactions to these things, and there was an emotional component to their argument, and they had feelings about these particular issues, not just rational, think like a lawyer thoughts about them. And I didn't. And I thought, these people are having these very authentic reactions. I'm not having them. I must be very different from them.
People have a lot of stereotypes about what it means to be a sociopath, and one of them is that sociopaths have no feelings or don't empathize with other people. You open the book with this kind of chilling story about, I think you were a teenager maybe, and a baby possum fell into your pool one day. Could you tell that story?
Yeah, so I had planned to do swimming lessons in the pool, and I walked out and was getting everything set, kickboards ready, and then I noticed there was splashing in the pool, and I got close enough to see that it was a baby possum, and I thought, well, we can't have swimming lessons in the pool with a baby possum. We have to get it out somehow. So in my mind, I thought the best, easiest way and the most risk-free way was to kill it, to help it drown, essentially. And then after it's dead, to get it out, because who knows, you know, you take it out and does it bite you? Does it have rabies? It just didn't seem like the benefits of trying to fish it out outweighed the potential cost.
So you just approached it purely rationally.
Yeah. When I did that, I didn't really think this is like a cruel thing to do or I'm enjoying killing this animal. It was purely this practical thing to do. And it was only in the retelling of it to other people did I realize that other people would have approached it very differently, you know, and would have had feelings of guilt almost at killing it. And I think feelings of guilt, I mean, it's a pest, right? It's a pest in the sense that it is an animal that's where it shouldn't be. And we kill animals like that all the time. You know, we have rat traps and we put down wild dogs. We just do this, right? But other people, their feelings about it are a lot more complicated than mine are, obviously.
So when you told that story to other people, did they kind of gasp and say, oh my God, why? Why did you do that?
Exactly. I was surprised that they were having these reactions. You know, that's another example of that happened in my like late teens, early 20s or something, of realizing that you're different. I thought it was almost not a story worth telling. Maybe I just told it on the offhand, like, why didn't you have swimming lessons today? Oh, I canceled them because there was an opossum in the pool that I tried to drown, but it didn't drown quick enough.
So what do you think is responsible for you being a sociopath?
Well, it's very hard to say. And, you know, I'm very careful to say always I'm a diagnosed sociopath. Who even knows what sociopathy means? I don't think there's nearly enough research to make any sort of for sure statements. But the research that has been done suggests that there's a genetic component. They've done twin studies and found that twins, you know, if one's a sociopath, the other one's much more likely to also be a sociopath. Most people's guess is it's about 50% genetic or 50% sort of inborn, and the rest comes from other sources, environmental, I guess. I would say, you know, if I had to trace the genetic link, it would come from my father's birth father, who abandoned him as a baby, knocked up my grandmother, shotgun wedding, abandoned. And we don't know that much about him because he never met the father, never knew him at all. But we do know that he was very sort of violent, aggressive, had maybe a mood disorder. He had a bunch of scars on his face from all the reckless activities he would engage in. And he ended up losing his money by buying a ranch. He fancied himself a cowboy and then ran the ranch into the ground. Mm. So if I had to guess, I would say he is the source of the genetics.
So once you got that diagnosis, and by now, you write in the book that you identify more as a sociopath than by your gender or profession or race. Can you talk more about that? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, it doesn't actually mean that I identify so strongly with being a sociopath. It largely means I don't identify with the other things. And I think one of the primary characteristics of sociopaths, what it feels like to be a sociopath, is to have a very weak sense of self. There's sort of no there there. I don't think of myself in these terms, female or part of a particular political party, or, you know, even my age, my ethnicity, even Mormonism to a certain extent. I've never really felt Mormon. So people see me and see all these different characteristics and treat me that way, but I never really think of myself in those terms. I think of myself more in terms of how I process things, how I think, rather than the results. So more like the formula rather than the particular inputs or the outputs of the formula.
But that's interesting that you say you don't have a sense of self. That's just such an interesting concept. For one thing, you must understand something about a sense of self to know that you don't have one.
Right.
How did you figure out what you were missing?
That's a good question. You know, not having a sense of self, what does it feel like? It sort of feels like I am a mirror or a camera. You know, I am just capturing other things. I think the figuring out that I didn't have a sense of self was experiencing things like the law school experience, where people had very strong opinions. And I always felt like the opinions I had were largely convenient. I had them for that particular context or for that particular moment, or maybe even just to portray a particular role in society, whatever I was doing. And I always thought I can change my mind the very next minute. So I think probably actually in my relationships, my personal relationships, is where it felt most obvious, because I felt that way. You know, I say this all the time, that tomorrow I could be out of a relationship if I happen to be in a relationship, that I make a decision to be whoever I am or whatever role that I have every day, make a decision to keep my job every day. I feel like I could quit every day. Same thing with relationships, same thing with everything that I participate in. I think I could move tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Constantly, I'm deciding these things. It's not something that's rigid or solid. I think that really scares people when they're in a relationship with me, because it doesn't seem secure.
Well, you also write that one of your favorite pastimes is what you call the fine art of ruining people, which you describe as inserting yourself in someone else's psyche and quietly wreaking as much havoc as you can. For example.
Well, yeah, favorite pastimes. I mean, I think that might be overstating it a little bit. I say in the book, it's sort of a delicacy that I engage in as often as I eat foie gras, which is, I mean, I haven't eaten foie gras in for forever. And ruining people, too. It's something that I did more before I was diagnosed and, you know, wasn't really aware of the consequences of some of my actions. But the appeal to ruining people was sort of an intimacy with people. I really like people. I actually do really like people, but it has been hard. You know, as I said, with relationships and other things, it's been hard to have any sort of sense of intimacy with people, emotional, physical, anything. And I think ruining people in some ways was just a way to interact with people. You know, it's like the difference between hugging somebody and roughhousing with them, punching them. They can mean the same thing, actually. They can both mean affection, or you want to engage with that particular thing. And so ruining people was almost like an emotional roughhousing.
What's an example? How have you ruined someone?
It's not like they actually are ruined. That's the biggest point, I guess, to make first, is they don't end up, you know, a shell of their former selves. It's just a mind game, basically. You try to get in their mind. You try to get them to like you, get them to sort of rely on you for particular things. You get them to wonder what your motives are. You're just playing mind games with them. It's like seducing them, probably, in a way, except the goal is not to, you know, be in a relationship with them or get them to do particular things. You just want to inhabit their mind. You want them to think of you and wonder what you think about.
You tell the story about this young, successful lawyer, Morgan, for instance, who, by the time you finished your relationship with her, you said she had been young and successful, and by the end she was an anorexic who'd lost her job and involved in substance abuse. That sounds like ruining.
Yeah, you know, Morgan, we're actually still friends, Morgan and I. I wouldn't take credit for those things. I do think that she, and this is something that I've kind of adapted over the years to seek after people who have sort of masochistic tendencies. For whatever reason, they're wanting to self-destruct or their life is unstable. And so I become a part of that. I don't necessarily lead them to do those things. Those were her choices, but her vulnerability and her instability, I think, attracted me because it was so easy to kind of get into her head. But I don't think she would think of me as a negative influence in her life, actually. You know, if anything, I've sort of been a stabilizing influence, or at least an interesting influence. She wants to engage in these sorts of things. And most people would really judge her for that sort of behavior and think, you're ruining your life, and how could you? And we're not going to support you anymore. And we're, you know, I'm going to stop being your friend because I just can't see you do this to yourself. And I was always supportive of whatever she chose to do. So
you've written that your view of morality is instrumental.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
I think I don't really have this emotional view of morality. It's largely ethically based. It's largely utilitarian. To the extent I have raised in the Mormon church and taught to serve others and that raised in a large family, I was able to see early on that when my siblings are happy, when my parents are happy, when people, my friends are happy, I'm happier. And so I really kind of took to this idea of utilitarian ethics.
You know, most of us believe we've never met a sociopath, but research shows that, in fact, they make up, I don't know what.
1 in 25. So 1 to 4% of the population.
And many of them have very successful careers. Can you recognize other sociopaths?
Sometimes I recognize sociopaths, and it is kind of scary to think, you know, statistically, everybody has met a sociopath, but most people cannot ever recall having met a sociopath. If they met a sociopath, they didn't know it. And I think that has happened to me, too. I think I've met sociopaths and not realized it. I've also met sociopaths and did realize it. I think there's kind of ways that you can tell. They tend to hold eye contact, and then it kind of becomes a staring contest. If it's sociopath against sociopath, then it's just like really intense staring at each other for however many minutes. There are other ways to try to flush people out. Sometimes I like to bring up the TV show Dexter and ask them how they feel about things, about Dexter. And if I think a lot of times sociopaths are sort of dropping hints, you know, about themselves. They want to be discovered. They rarely flat out lie. They largely kind of tell the truth in ways that are not really going to out themselves, but they can still express their own authentic thoughts about something.
M.E. Thomas is the author of Confessions of a Sociopath, A Life Spent Hiding in Plain Sight. She spoke with N. Strange Champs.